revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a guest that returns to us and somebody I really enjoyed speaking with because she's on the cutting edge of one of the most important parts of our society, and that's the education system. We've talked about how it's changed and how the parents need to take their power back. And sometimes it feels overwhelming, but I think Ms. Carrie McDonald is at the forefront and is part of the solution. And if you don't know what you don't know, then you can't make any educational or informed decisions. So let's introduce her briefly. This is Ms. Carrie McDonald. She works at the intersection of education and enterprise, spotlighting the entrepreneurs who are building creative schooling options across the United States. She's a senior fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education, where she leads the Education Entrepreneurship Lab and hosts Liberated podcast. She's also the Valinda Johnson Family Education Fellow at State Policy Network, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, and a regular contributor at Forbes.com and The 74. She's a best-selling author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom, and the author of a new book called Joyful Learning, How to Find Freedom, Happiness, and Success Beyond Conventional Schooling. And she's, from a education standpoint, she has a BA in economics from Bowdoin College and a master's degree in education policy from Harvard. She's a mom and she lives in Massachusetts. And Ms. McDonald, I want to thank you so much for joining me because we hear so much doom and gloom about our education system, but I think you're here to tell us that parents and children have choices, don't they?
Oh, it's so great to be back on your show, Dr. George. Thank you so much for having me. Yes, it is such an exciting time in education. I've been involved in education and education policy for over 20 years, and I've never been more optimistic and energized than I am right now because of all of the choices increasingly available to parents and learners all across the U.S. And that's really what Joyful Learning details, is sort of these emerging schooling models, innovative educational programs such as microschools and learning pods, low-cost private schools, hybrid homeschool programs, homeschool collaboratives, all sorts of really great educational options for families that have been around for a while, but have really skyrocketed in terms of abundance and interest over the past 5 years.
That's amazing. I love when a good idea just mushrooms. And I love the fact that you mentioned so many different varieties of educational choices, because I'm a big fan of one size does not fit all. And if parents and children want to do something different, it's like a laboratory where you just put it out there and there's people who are going to run with the ball. So I think it's fascinating. But let's start from the beginning. What made you go into this side of education? How did you not get demoralized like a lot of people?
Yeah, so it's so interesting. You know, I was an economics major as an undergrad back in the late 1990s. I fell in love with economics, and I just became curious about why it was that we have so much choice, variety, and abundance in so many other parts of our lives, but not so much in K-12 education. And to your point, largely that's because it's sort of a one-size-fits-all, you know, government-run system that, doesn't leave a lot of room or didn't leave a lot of room for innovation and entrepreneurship. And so that just sort of stuck with me. And I began to wonder, well, what were families doing kind of outside of conventional schooling, even though there were limited options? And so that got me interested in homeschooling and alternatives to conventional schooling. I went to graduate school in education policy, became interested in the charter school sector, kind of the early 2000s. Charter schools started to come on the scene in, full force. Charter schools, of course, tuition-free, public schools that are taxpayer funded, but typically privately run by nonprofit organizations. They have more autonomy and freedom to experiment. So I spent some time, you know, researching the charter sector and seeing how these charter schools were being incubated in the kind of early 2000s. But I still wondered about kind of alternatives to conventional schooling, even in the charter sector. What else could there be if we looked at education more creatively? And was always really fascinated about homeschooling from being able to shadow a homeschooling family when I was an undergraduate and just being completely captivated by this learning outside of a conventional classroom and kind of this authentic immersion and the people, places, and things of one's community. That really stuck with me. So sort of fast forward, kind of beyond my time in policy and kind of education as a scholar, started thinking about education choices for my own family when my husband and I had our first of four children, and decided we would homeschool. Because we live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, have access to so many wonderful resources around us in terms of libraries and historic sites and museums and all sorts of things, and just felt like that would be a way to kind of cultivate, nurture their curiosity and creativity, and kind of took it year by year and just really fell in love with alternatives to conventional schooling for our own family. And that was the journey that I documented in my 2019 book that was called Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside of a Conventional Classroom, which I was, when I was back on your show a couple of years ago, was the book that we were chatting about then, that detailed not only sort of my personal perspective as a parent and the choices that we made in terms of homeschooling and self-directed education, but also in that book, I talked about kind of the growth and diversification of homeschooling movement over the previous decades. I talked about the sort of nascent microschooling movement or these, you know, learning centers for homeschoolers and low-cost private schools that were beginning to emerge. And of course, then 2020 hit and everybody became a homeschooler in some way, in some fashion or other. Although again, those of us who were independently homeschooling prior to COVID, you know, so, well, this is a real homeschooling, but still, I think it gave a taste of learning differently for families. I think families during that period of education disruption with school closures and remote learning, I think it prompted parents to kind of poke their head up and say, well, what else is out there now that my local district school is closed for in-person learning? Maybe remote learning wasn't working well for their kids. And so they started to investigate other options. And that was when they discovered this homeschooling and microschooling and the different ways that teaching and learning could look outside of a traditional school. And so we saw in 2020 skyrocketing rates of homeschooling, a more than doubling of the homeschooling population in 2020, a fivefold increase in the number of Black homeschooling families that year. More and more parents creating what at the time were called pandemic pods, which were sort of these early stage micro schools, just families getting together saying, how can we make learning work kind of in a bottom up organic way? Schools are closed, remote learning is not desirable in many cases. How can we kind of pool our resources as neighbors and families in our community to enable our kids to continue to learn and get together, you know, in these small groups? And what ended up really happening in full force kind of after beginning in 2020 and continuing now is many of those pandemic pods evolved into full-fledged microschools or low-cost private schools. And that has inspired more and more entrepreneurial parents and teachers to create their own new schools and spaces since then.
There's always this infrastructure, whether it's healthcare, definitely in the education system. Was there pushback from the established educational system? Because there's always this fiefdom of the money goes where the child goes. Was there a lot of pushback? Did you have to jump any hurdles to get this started?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, maybe one of the silver linings of the pandemic response was that it kind of unleashed a lot of kind of ethos of permissionless education. So, you know, parents just had to make things work, and they weren't waiting around to see if they had permission to do these sorts of things, like have these little pandemic pods in their homes or get together and create a microschool. They just had to do it because schools were shut down, and, you know, there was a lot of sort of chaos. And so I think that that empowered a lot of families, not only to try something new and create something for their community, but also encouraged other parents to take the leap and give something new a try, because it did seem like sort of an unprecedented time of education disruption. And, you know, in terms of pushback, I think, you know, some of the stories that I document in the book is filled with, Joyful Learning is filled with the stories of over 50 entrepreneurial parents and teachers, 50 founders of these new schools and spaces, most of whom created these programs in the last 5 years. And the vast majority of them are former public school teachers who themselves became, you know, disillusioned with the sort of one-size-fits-all standardization and regimentation of traditional schooling and wanted to do something different. And COVID and the response to COVID really provided that catalyst for them to take a leap into entrepreneurship. In chapter one, for example, of Joyful Learning, I give the story of Jill Perez, who was a longtime public school teacher in the New Jersey public schools. She was there for over a decade and then had shifted into student teaching at the university level, supervising teachers in training at Rutgers University and Seton Hall University. And that's what she was doing when COVID hit and all of her student teachers went online, remote learning, and her four school-age children's schools were shut down. So she, as a parent, also had to scramble to create something new for them. And she created a pandemic pod for her four kids and others in her neighborhood and her community. And people started to get wind of this really creative educational approach that she was kind of making up as she went along, and really being creative with how she was approaching her pod. And families really wanted to continue. More families wanted to join her pod. So even as schools began to reopen in the fall of 2021, kind of over a year after she had been running her pod, she created a microschool called Tranquil Teachings Learning Center that operates as a full-time schooling alternative for students who are technically considered homeschoolers, but they can come full-time or part-time and kind of choose the right mix and right enrollment option for them at a fraction of the cost of traditional private schools in the area. And she was able to recruit teachers from the New York City public schools who were burnt out and disillusioned themselves and wanted to do something different. And her program continues to flourish today. She now has over 100 K-8 students in her program, and just finding a lot of joy, not only for herself as an educator, but also her families and her students. You know, are just so satisfied with what she's created.
It sounds like it. And what strikes me with what you were giving your overview is that economics, I mean, this seems like it's available to whatever economic strata you're in. If you don't have a lot of money, it doesn't lock you out. And you can get quality education without having to be, for lack of a better way, privileged in some way, economically or where you live. It sounds like it's very egalitarian.
Yeah, I think that's what's particularly fascinating, exciting, and disruptive about these sort of emerging K-12 schooling models is that they are so much more financially accessible to more families. These are not what we think of as typical pricey private schools. These are very affordable. In fact, the National Microschooling Center does some wonderful research and data collection around today's microschools and emerging schooling models. And they find that 3/4 of today's microschools cost less than $10,000 a year. A third cost less than $5,000 a year. Only 3% cost over $20,000 a year. So these are already much more affordable options for more families. And that's why, you know, even places like New Jersey, where you're seeing kind of a growth in these models, but they're taking off, these new schools and spaces, in states that have robust school choice policies, school choice programs that enable a portion of education allocated funding to go to families to choose whatever educational option works best for them. And often in these states, particularly states that have universal school choice programs that apply to all K to 12 students in the state, many families are able to access these new schools and spaces tuition free or nearly so with one of these school choice programs, like an education savings account. So although this movement is occurring everywhere in states with school choice programs and in states without school choice programs, there's no doubt that it's accelerating in states that have robust school choice programs. And that's another development that we've seen mm-hmm. over the past 5 years in the wake of the pandemic, is that, again, school choice policies were gaining traction prior to 2020, just like, you know, microschooling and homeschooling were, but really took off since then, particularly in the wake of school closures, so that now we have more than a dozen states that have universal choice programs, 35 states plus DC and Puerto Rico that have some version of private school choice that enable, again, families to choose the private education option that works well for them.
This is how it should be. Just, you have a problem, people get together and they solve it in a way that is user-friendly and independent. So let's take our first break, because I want to ask a bit about these states that are user-friendly. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Ms. Carrie McDonald, and she's talking to us about real choice and real education from the ground up. I don't think I ever said, but my school was 13 people in my graduating class, and I was there for 12 years, and it really was like a family, and it was not expensive. So what I got from my educational experience was everybody's an individual, and if you wanted to do things in a different way, there was somebody, a teacher, who was there to guide you down that path. So to me, this is right up my alley in the way that people learn, because it isn't one size fits all. And you mentioned some states are user friendly to this. I remember Florida, for example. Did they not come up with one of the earlier states to come up with monies that could be used, taken out of the system and given to micro schools?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Florida and Arizona really lead the country in terms of the extent to which their school choice programs reach families and the variety of programs that are eligible to be used as part of these programs. And they've had school choice, both states, for many years, although they weren't universal until recently. But because there's been this sort of culture built up around parental choice in education, I think that that's also why we're seeing so much growth in terms of educational entrepreneurship and innovation, all of these new schools emerging, particularly in states like Florida and Arizona. Arizona was the first state to pass universal eligibility school choice. They did that in 2022. Now we have 17 states just in the last 3 years and growing. And then states that may not be fully universal are expanding to include more families and increasing income thresholds and so forth. So it's really a game changer. More and more families have options. They're able to find just the right educational fit for their kids. And I think what we're seeing now are really the network effects of this. I think that we're now seeing, particularly in places like Florida, now that there are so many more of these schools, that other prospective education entrepreneurs, aspiring school founders, feel confident to take their own entrepreneurial leaps and create their own new schools, because there's sort of this network of resources and tools available for them. I mentioned the National Microschooling Center. There's many other sort of microschool accelerator and incubator programs that can help a founder get a school from idea to launch in a few months and create something that really families really want. I find that many cases, these new schools quickly fill up and end up with wait lists, because families really are clamoring for something new and different in education, and we're seeing the effects sort of reflected in declining public school enrollment, particularly in states like Florida that have so many more options around homeschooling, microschooling, charter schools, private schools, that traditional district schools continue to lose enrollment faster than was predicted. We've seen declining birth rates in the U.S. over the past decade plus, but even beyond that, there's been more public school enrollment declines than expected, and that's because of these new options for families.
That, you know, from an economic standpoint, it makes me think about the whether the parent has to work and they have to leave the home, and how much child care costs in this typical system. Is there some support for parents who do have to work, that their children is a child is able to access the system, but they're not prohibitively expensive in terms of getting daycare or some sort of child care? Is that also an adjunct to this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, most of the schools and spaces that I spotlight in Joyful Learning and the people that I interview on my podcast are people who are running programs that can be sort of a full-time substitute for traditional schooling. So these could run up to 5 days a week for families. Some of them operate legally as programs for homeschoolers. Often that's because running as a homeschool program provides more freedom and flexibility for families around enrollment options and curriculum choice. Sometimes these programs will run as state-recognized private schools. So there's a whole variety of different structures, but what makes them, what's sort of the common thread among all of these different creative schooling options is they're highly individualized. They're really focused on each individual learner, not a collective of learners. Kind of saying, you know, okay, you're a 10-year-old. Where are you in terms of math and reading? Not here's this kind of top-down, one-size-fits-all curriculum, but really recognizing that, you know, there could be differences in learners. Maybe they're a 10-year-old who's reading at, you know, a high school reading level, but might need a little bit more help in math. And so now with all of these wonderful curriculum options available, there's more opportunities to kind of differentiate instruction for each child. And so it makes sense that we create schools that enable that kind of differentiated mastery-based learning. So really focused on individualized education, flexible educational options, mm-hmm. often in terms of enrollment. These programs are often mixed age. So again, they're kind of this one-room schoolhouse model, not necessarily looking at all fourth graders in a room or all sixth graders in a room, but a much more community-based program that's mixed age, multi-age, and low cost. Affordability is, again, the kind of key factor that separates these emerging schooling models from traditional private schools.
So my next question dovetails with that. If you have so much variety and people are able to do their individual pursuits, how does that feed into the bigger picture? Are there testing? Are there benchmarks that the schools have to meet in order to keep a cohesive education system going?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're really seeing is the emergence of a decentralized marketplace in education, and something that we haven't seen much before. And so that's what makes this really exciting, is that families now are able to kind of pick and choose the kind of education environment that they want, that's aligned with their personal values and viewpoints, that works well for their child. For some families, that might be a farm or forest school, right? Maybe some families say, I want my kid outside, stomping in the mud, you know, playing in nature, and that's what's really important to me. And then another family might say, I want a classical educational model with uniforms and patent leather shoes and kind of a core curriculum, and everything in between. And that's what really makes it such a dynamic ecosystem that we're seeing emerge, because families are able to kind of pick and choose. They're able to find programs that have the educational philosophy that speaks to them, again, whether that's a nature school or Montessori or Waldorf or some kind of fusion of all of those options, whether it's faith-based or secular, whether it's a progressive approach to learning or a more conservative approach. There's that that choice, that variety, that abundance in education now. And so families are making decisions and kind of demonstrating accountability in their own consumer choices, right? So the schools and spaces that are succeeding, that are thriving, are the ones that are satisfying their customers, mm-hmm. are the ones who find that families are happy to be there, students are happy to be there. They're the ones that are being maintained and often scaling, often growing to new locations. Whereas ones that are not meeting the needs of their families and learners will shut down. And that, to me, is a good signal of a healthy decentralized marketplace, similar to what we have in other kind of consumer goods and services.
I mean, that's really how the market should work, right? If you have a good product and it meets the needs of its customers and it's customer-centered, then it should thrive. And in this case, having children be their fullest, you know, reach their full capacity without being somehow tamped down. That makes perfect sense to me. I love the fact that you mentioned you can be really great at one thing, but you need help in something else. And instead of being just pay attention to the bad, you can actually encourage people because you have good at something. You just want to expand that. So it seems to see the good in the child, not what they can't do, but what they can.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's also this recognition that there's no reason to kind of move a child along in a curriculum until they've actually mastered that content. Mm-hmm. You know, like now we have sort of just-in-time curriculum materials and different kinds of curriculum. So maybe a child is learning math and one particular curriculum approach just isn't working well for that child. Well, now you can try different curriculum approaches. And that's what a lot of these micro school founders and similar entrepreneurial educators are doing. They're able to see how the child tailor the curriculum accordingly, and make sure you know they're not moving on to you know geometry or trigonometry until they've really mastered algebra. and again, that now there's these personalized you know learning tools that make that more doable and more enjoyable for kids.
Well, it certainly goes against the social promotion that existed in the regular standard system. On that note, let's take our second break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Miss Carrie McDonald. And Carrie, how can people get your book, your books?
Yes. Yeah, so the books are available wherever you purchase books. Joyful Learning is, I just went to my local bookstore. It's on bookstore shelves there. Or you can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Wherever you prefer to buy your books. It's also available in audiobook. So if you're like me who loves to listen to audiobooks while I'm cleaning the house or making dinner, you can get the Audible version, which I narrate.
I love that. So speaking of disruptions, what about the textbook industry? So you're not standardizing anything. It's not like everybody's got the same template. So how is that disrupting the I mean, if you can answer that, I'm just curious because it was a big business for a while.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good point. I mean, I do think that large textbook suppliers recognize this interest in personalized learning, including efforts of, you know, traditional public schools and public school districts to try to personalize learning. So we've seen, you know, growth in that market. But, you know, there's also these more bespoke curriculum providers, individual entrepreneurs who are creating their own curriculum resources that either families can purchase themselves or that microschool founders can purchase and use. So that's also kind of another segment of this market. I don't talk so much about it in Joyful Learning because I'm focused more on the founders of these schools and spaces and less about the kind of curriculum that they're choosing. But they will tell me in interviews that I have with them on my podcast and in my articles of the different, you know, curriculum materials that they'll use. And they find that, you know, some kids will really gravitate toward one particular curriculum approach and other kids will prefer something else. Mm-hmm. And that's what's the beauty of kind of just-in-time learning and a much more bespoke approach to education.
It, you know, it sounds to me as well as there's a critical thinking aspect to this, because you have to think on the fly to meet the needs of your students, right? So if it's not gelling or if they're not excited about it, you really can't just keep doing the same thing and expect a different result or pass them along when they haven't mastered something. So there's accountability in this that I don't think, to me, is the same. It's really, you can't hide in the system, whether you're teaching or whether you're a student.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting, back to the point that the majority of the founders that I spotlight in the book and that I interview overall are former public school teachers. I think we forget that teacher creativity and autonomy is often just as stifled in a traditional classroom as student creativity and autonomy. And I've, you know, had so many teachers say, this isn't what I went into teaching for. You know, I didn't go into teaching so that I could be teaching to a test or so that I could be following some top-down curriculum mandate that doesn't work well for my students. And so they find a lot of freedom outside of the system to be more creative, to be more autonomous. And then when they're hiring teachers to work in their new schools, that those teachers are also finding so much more professional fulfillment. I talked to one founder in Florida, South Florida, who's running a successful microschool, and she had posted a job posting on Indeed.com, one of the large job posting sites, and this was in kind of mid-fall, so the academic year was underway, but she's hiring a new teacher, and she quickly got hundreds of applications, most from current public school teachers who were, you know, working in the system, but really wanted more of that autonomy and creativity, wanted to be part of something new and different. And if she had lifted her salary, which was lower than what teachers would be making in the conventional school system, and they were still flocking to her and responding to her job posting because they wanted that unique educational environment.
I mean, that's why you want to be a teacher, right? To be able to see that spark, given the time and the creativity to create the spark in that child. And, you know, this, it's not just the education system. I think healthcare is doing the same thing.
Yeah.
It's like a conveyor belt mentality. You teach to a test. There's no thought, just the end point. But in between, there's no fun. I don't understand. And I don't think that is, at least in the area, in the era of AI, where you can just put, you know, ask some chat bot and get an answer. That's not really what education's about. It's being able to think and have the tools to expand your knowledge base, whether you're 2 or 92, right?
Yeah, I think it's really important that you brought up kind of the corollaries between education and healthcare, that, you know, physicians are finding freedom, happiness, and success outside of the system in unique ways, in the same way that educators are, and patients and families really benefiting from those entrepreneurial efforts. So, yeah, similar patterns there. And then, you know, just kind of to hone in on this point around joy and fulfillment. I mean, the reason that I call the book Joyful Learning is that despite the tremendous diversity of models and methods featured in this book. Again, all kinds of different educational philosophies, all kinds of different approaches, different values and viewpoints of founders. Despite all of that diversity, the kind of common thread among all of these spaces, and I visited hundreds of these schools the last 5 years, are the, I visited and interviewed founders in the past 5 years, is the joy that you hear from the founders and the families who are participating in these programs. And one of my favorite stories from the book is the story of a Waldorf-inspired microschool in suburban Philadelphia that was started in early 2024 by a teacher, longtime public school teacher in the Philadelphia Public Schools, Jennifer Kempin. And she decided to create a home-based, again, Waldorf-inspired microschool, Waldorf education, one particular type of educational approach focused on child-centered learning. And she wanted this for her son and kind of put out a message on social media and her Facebook page and said, hey, I'm creating this program for my kid, anyone else interested? And she, within a week, had filled up her program. It was small. It was initially about six kids. And families were really wanting what she was building. And she opened in just after New Year's in early 2024, again, in her home with this handful of students. And then their first snow day, a few weeks later, one of the parents said, my son was so upset that he couldn't go to school today because there was a snow day. And here was a kid who hated going to school before. In fact, of kind of the startup group of students she had, most of them really disliked school. Some of them had kind of school-related trauma. They had experienced bullying. School was not a pleasant place for them. And they had tried lots of different types of schools. But it was the fact that this was sort of this interesting, small, home-based micro school that enabled them to kind of rekindle their love of learning to the point that they didn't want to be home on a snow day, right? And so then a few weeks later, another parent said, oh, this has been such a great experience for my child. He's thriving here. She actually had all boys at the beginning of her program. And the parents said, I'm sort of dreading summer vacation when we have to kind of scramble to piece together different summer camps and have the disruption from, you know, 1 week to another of a different camp and getting adjusted. And that can be difficult for kids. And Jennifer said, well, I would do year-round school if the kids wanted to. We don't have to stop. She was thinking about how she would also not like to have to kind of scramble to do summer camps for her son. And so she said, let's ask the kids what they think. When she asked the kids if they wanted to continue going to her micro school all year round, not have summer vacation, they squealed in delight.
Wow.
And this is not unusual. This is what I hear time and again from students, from families. Kids are happy to be there. They want to go to school. In many cases, kind of the polar opposite of their experience previously in a different classroom environment. And teachers and founders want to go to school. They want to be a part of this experience.
I mean, that's joy. Everybody gets to experience it. The parents are, when they send their kids, they're not worried about what's going to happen in school. The child is not stressed about having to meet someone after class, you know, back in the day. And it's just, it's such an inviting and comforting kind of environment. That is the best situation to learn in my opinion.
Yeah.
Wow. Right.
Yeah. And so, but, you know, kind of back to your point around accountability and, you know, how do we measure these results? I mean, these founders are measuring quality, measuring results in all kinds of different ways. Many of them still use, you know, kind of standardized tests. They will do intake assessments to see where a young person is in terms of different ability levels, but they will kind of use these tests to guide instruction and curriculum choices, not sort of a drill and test sort of environment that we might see in a more conventional space. And others will try to measure things like joy. How much do kids want to be there? They'll use, you know, parent satisfaction surveys, student satisfaction surveys. They'll look at portfolios of student work and retention rates and referral rates and all of the ways that we're able to judge kind of quality and success in other goods and services we're really starting to see in K-12 education.
And for the children, you know, there's a breadth of children, right? There's the children who have some learning disabilities or physical disabilities. And sometimes they're really lumped in a way that it's just warehousing. Are there micro schools that are geared to children with learning disabilities or behavioral issues? Because that's something that parents really do need help with as well.
Many, many, many of these schools are serving the needs of neurodiverse learners, students with dyslexia or dysgraphia, ADHD, other behavioral issues. often because these students aren't being well served in a conventional classroom. I mentioned again that most of the founders I interview are former public school teachers. A large percentage of those public school teachers are former special education teachers in public schools who tried valiantly to create individualized education plans for students and really tried to differentiate learning within the system for students with special learning needs, and still kind of came up against barriers and obstacles to being able to do that. And so then they go off and create programs either that are specifically focused on the needs of neurodiverse students or those with special learning needs, or I think is more what is more common is blending kind of neurodiverse and neurotypical students in a nurturing environment that serves all kids in really meaningful ways. But I do talk in the book about schools specifically for this one, for example, one outdoor school in Utah called Breakout School that's specifically for students with autism and ADHD. There's another school in Portland, Oregon, specifically for students with dyslexia. So there are all kinds of different options, and that's where I think it's a great time for entrepreneurial parents and teachers to think about the kind of school they want, that they could create and make that dream a reality.
That's amazing. So we're creating a whole group of children who are going to come out to be, I would think, empathetic, who are feel good about themselves, who are going to add to society in a positive way.
Yeah, I mean, I think what just seeing students become more engaged in their learning, either not lose that spark of learning through kind of years of disenchantment in a conventional system, or having that love of learning rekindled in one of these smaller, more nurturing educational environments, that's going to be, you know, world changing. As young people, you know, are happy to go to school, are thriving, are learning in ways that matter to them, that are tied to their own, you know, special learning approaches, and mastering content.
Wow. I mean, it's just, we need more of it, as much as we can get.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. I mean, this is just an enlightening conversation and really hopeful. I mean, there's so much out there. It feels like the best kept secret, but it's becoming less of a secret as we go on. How can people listen to your podcast and read what you write?
Yeah, so you can go to liberatedpodcast.com. There you'll see links to all my episodes. And it's interesting because I started the podcast in February of 2022 and very quickly had such a backlog of episodes that I had to boost the podcast from once a week to twice a week because there were so many of these entrepreneurial parents and teachers creating these new schools and spaces. And so now there's over 350 episodes of, you know, everyday entrepreneurs, people who never really expected to be running a school. Again, many teachers who didn't think that they would even leave a traditional classroom, but have found so much joy and fulfillment outside of that environment. And are now, you know, encouraging others to go off and create their own new schools and spaces. I mentioned before about the network effects that we're seeing in these founder communities where other, you know, current teachers might look to these, you know, new school founders and say, well, if she can do it, so can I. You know, she doesn't have any superpowers that I don't have. And so they feel more encouraged, more inspired to do that. And then more families are starting to, you know, hear about these new programs and realize that they might have an affordable, individualized school or learning space in their own neighborhoods, in their own communities, in some cases that they didn't even know existed. And what I think is even more true, and certainly what I document in Joyful Learning, is that many of these programs come about because parents can't find what they're looking for their own kids, so they go off and build it, right? And it's to your point, it's build the solution that you're looking for your communities. Such a decentralized, bottom-up, entrepreneurial movement of education innovation.
For those parents, let's say you have a neurodivergent child and there's not an educational resource in your city, your community. Do they have any, like, you can, I guess, for lack of a way to put it, like a boarding school type of environment that they can go to?
I have not come across those, but it could be a solution that some entrepreneur could build, right? Yeah, I don't have any examples of that in Joyful Learning or that I've come across. Obviously, we have, you know, traditional boarding schools, but some of these innovative ones, I don't know, I'll have to do some sleuthing and see what I can find.
Okay. Okay. Glad to, you know, put that out there. So we talked about the nurturing side of it. What about the, after you graduate, what's the matriculation rate? Do the children go off on average to college? What do they do?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of these micro schools are, you know, relatively new. And I would say that especially the ones that have emerged over the past 5 years tend to focus more on elementary school.
Okay.
But inevitably, you know, founders will hear from families, oh, will you please do a middle school? My child is so happy here. He's flourishing. You know, can you just go up another grade? And so they'll often extend to be sort of a K-8 model. And then they'll say, oh, we're not doing high school. But sure enough, then the families will say, please do high school. So you are seeing sort of this gradual addition of grades, including the high school years. But I think, if, you know, looking at kind of outcomes, I mean, it's helpful to look at data around homeschoolers, which are probably the largest and kind of most documented group of learners that are learning in an unconventional environment. And, you know, over the years, they have had no trouble going off to college. In fact, data from ACT.org, the ACT exam, one of the standardized college entrance exams along with the SAT, but the ACT has been tracking data for homeschoolers, private school students, and public school students since 2001. And since that time, they have consistently found that homeschoolers and private school students have far outperformed public school students on the ACT exam again since 2001. So there are those metrics. I think then also there's anecdotal stories of programs that have been working with teens for years. I talk about one of them in Joyful Learning, North Star, which is a self-directed micro school for tweens and teens in Western Massachusetts that also created a global micro school network of similar schools back in 2013. And then that has seen growing interest in recent years. And they've been able to kind of look at the careers and college pathways that graduates have gone off to and say, you know, they'll go there. All doors are open. They can get into selective colleges if they choose. They can go into the workforce if they choose, into vocational careers, entrepreneurship. So all sorts of pathways. And I think that, that's true of this larger micro school movement as well.
That's great. That's diversity in its classic sense, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, just being able to open multiple pathways to adulthood for young people, I think is really important.
So that also makes me think about the socialization side of this. One of the things that strike me, thank goodness I'm not in school anymore, because these cliques and these social, it's like you're going through a minefield. How do children do when they have to interact with children who go to the standard school system?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point. Certainly we've seen data, again, coming out of the homeschool population for a number of years that finds that, you know, students, for example, who have been homeschooled their whole life and then go off into college have no trouble adjusting to college life. Do well academically, are able to form, you know, close relationships with peers and professors. So there's those kinds of research, but there's that kind of research that's out there. And I think the other thing to think about too is a lot of these schools and spaces are collaborating with other micro schools in their communities to kind of build a larger community outside of maybe one learning space. So if you have one micro school that has 50 kids, they might be collaborating increasingly with, you know, other, you know, six or seven other micro schools in that area. That's what it's so promising, and particularly in places with robust school choice policies that are truly accelerating the growth of these programs. You could have you know, dozens of these new schools and spaces in a, you know, fairly tight geographic area, who then can pool resources and have enrichment opportunities and sporting events and clubs and all of that to expand that social network.
Well, it sounds like it's a full circle and, you know, full color experience as a child, not just learning, but also, you know, having fun in the classic sense, joining a team, joining a club. So it's got everything, it sounds like.
Yeah, I really think we're at this transformative moment in American education where we're increasingly moving from a system that's been largely defined as sort of top-down, standardized and stagnant, to one that is bottom-up and individualized and innovative. And it's thanks to entrepreneurial parents and teachers, just individuals wanting to create solutions for their families and those in their community.
So if I'm a parent and I'm listening to this podcast and I'm like, I have to do this, how can people start the process of getting information and getting their child into one of these micro schools or any of the homeschools?
Yeah, well, I would definitely recommend checking out Joyful Learning, reading or listening to it, because it's really designed for both families and founders seeking or building one of these creative schooling options. So lots of kind of how-to guides to either find one of these programs or to build one of these programs. I'd also recommend folks go to the Education Entrepreneurship Lab at FEE, which I lead, which has so many resources and inspirational articles for families and founders. And you can go there at edentrepreneur.org if you're a family or a founder seeking or building one of these programs.
And the time goes way too fast, but I want to make sure people know again how to access your podcast, how to buy your books.
So the book, again, is Joyful Learning, How to Find Freedom, Happiness, and Success Beyond Conventional Schooling. You can get that wherever books are sold. And you can also listen to my podcast at liberatedpodcast.com and buy the book there as well.
I want to thank you so much for joining me today, because this was fast-paced but chock full of information. But what strikes me really by what you do is you are creating a foundation for our future. You know, I was kind of dubious about our education system, but with this now as the alternative, and I think it's going to become the go-to, if not already, it's giving me hope that the next generation is going to be able to pick up and thrive where we leave off.
Yeah. And I'll say, I mean, it's not me creating it. It's the entrepreneurial parents and teachers. I'm just the storyteller. I feel so honored to be able to share the stories of these inspirational educators who are building the solutions that families in their community want and that learners deserve.
I agree with you. And I want to thank you for everything you do. And thank you so much for joining me today. I really can't wait to have you back on.
Thanks, Dr. George. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk Events.